Good evening, and welcome to this evening's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Karen Kiefer, a member of the International Relations Member-Led Forum, and your chair for this evening's program, in which we are partnering with NORCAL Peace Corps Association and the club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Lyra Boroditsky is an assistant professor of psychology, neuroscience, and symbolic systems at Stanford University, and she is also editor-in-chief of Frontiers in Cultural Psychology. Her research centers on how knowledge emerges out of the interactions of mind, world, and language, and the ways that languages and cultures shape human thinking. To this end, Professor Boroditsky's laboratory, she calls Cognition, has collected data around the world from Indonesia to Chile to Turkey to Aboriginal Australia. Her research has been widely featured in the media and has won multiple awards, including the Career Award from the National Science Foundation, the Searle Scholars Award, and the McDonnell Scholars Award. Now, Professor Boroditsky, I'd like to welcome you to the podium.
Thank you. I think I'll put it over here. Oh, that's good. Thank you very much for having me. I want to talk about how the languages we speak shape the way we think. And all conversations on this topic start with the basic observation that languages really differ from one another in what they require of their speakers. Even the simplest thing, let's take the example, a nursery rhyme, Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Even if you try to translate something that simple, you immediately run into problems. So let's just take the verb, sat. If you say that in English, you have to mark whether or not this is an event that happened in the past, or something that will happen in the future, or something is happening now. So is sitting, will sit, sat, was sitting. There are all these options, and you have to choose the right one. Now, in some languages, you don't have to change the verb. In fact, you can't change the verb. So in Mandarin or in Indonesian, the verb always remains the same. It's always sit. In some languages, you have to change the verb for tense. You also have to add other information. So in Russian, my native language, you have to mark whether it's a male or a female doing the action. So if it was Mrs. Dumpty that sat on the wall, it would be a different form of the verb than if it's Mr. Dumpty. In Russian also, you have to mark whether the action is completed or not. So if Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall for the entire time that he had intended to sit on the wall, that would be one form of the verb. But if he were to, say, have a great fall or something else happened, then it would be a different form of the verb. In some languages, like Turkish, you have to change the verb depending on how you came to know about this information. So in Turkish, if you saw a chubby, ovoid character sitting on a wall and you saw this with your own eyes, then that would be one form of the verb. But if this is something you just heard about or something you inferred, that would be a different form of the verb. And there are countless examples like this, countless distinctions. Every new language you go to, you find something new that's required, some new kind of information that the language asks the speakers to pay attention to. Now, on the one side, people have said, look at how different languages are from one another. That must mean that speakers of different languages really attend to and encode and remember their worlds really differently just by virtue of what their languages require of them. On the other side, people have said, well, not so fast, just because languages ask people to talk differently doesn't necessarily mean they think differently. It's possible that everyone actually thinks the same way, notices all the same things. So speakers of Russian and Turkish and Indonesian all notice all the same things and know all the same things. They just happen to pick one little bit or another little bit to talk about. So it's just a difference in how people talk. It's not really a difference in how people think. So that's kind of been the debate. And this is a debate that goes back a very long time. And there are lots of interesting questions to ask here. For example, it's not just a simple yes or no, does language shape thought? You could ask, do speakers of different languages think differently by virtue of the languages that they speak? That's one question. But another way you could ask the question is, does learning new languages change the way you think? So if you're taking a French class or a Japanese class, are you just learning a new way of talking, or are you actually learning a new way of thinking? Right? Is language merely a way for expressing your thoughts, or is it actually changing the very thoughts that you wish to express? Another way to ask the question is to say, well, take a polyglot or a bilingual, someone who speaks lots of languages, and test them in one language or another. Do people who speak multiple languages, do they think differently depending on the language that they're speaking in the moment? So if you speak Spanish and English, are you seeing the world the same way when you're speaking one language versus another? Some bilinguals report that they feel like they're a different person. People say, oh, I feel like I'm a different person when I'm speaking Spanish than when I'm speaking English. Is there a truth to that? And ultimately, of course, what we want to know is, you know, why do we think the things that we think? Why does the world appear to us the way that it appears to us? Why do we do the things that we do? How do we come to be so smart and sophisticated? Humans are incredibly smart and sophisticated. We know all these incredibly complicated things. We've built all this incredibly complicated knowledge. What role does language and the structures in language play in building all that knowledge? So these are the questions at stake. And as I mentioned, this is a question that goes back a really long way. So empirical investigations on this question started in this century, but people have been speculating about this for centuries. So, for example, Charlemagne, emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, said, to have a second language is to have a second soul. That's a very strong statement. One of his successors, Charles V, says, a man who knows four languages is worth four men. Again, that places a lot of value on knowing a language. Frederick the Great of Prussia had a much more specific set of hypotheses. He says, I speak English to my accountants, French to my ambassadors, Italian to my mistress, Latin to my god, and German to my horse. I'm not sure where he got that particular hypothesis. But people have been expressing these kinds of ideas for a really long time. So people have been arguing, not just any people, but scholars, important scholars, have been arguing for why the language that they think in is the best one for whatever it is that they need to do. So my language is the best for oratory, or my language is the best for rational thought. So that's already an interesting phenomenon to notice, that people feel very much aligned with the structures of their language. They feel that their language fits the structure of their thinking well. Now, not everyone has been very happy with this idea. The idea that language shapes thought really fell out of favor in scientific circles over the last century, so especially over the last half a century or so. And one of the main reasons was there's very little empirical investigation, empirical evidence for this idea. There are a lot of big claims that people make, kind of like Frederick the Great of Prussia about whole nations and their nature, but very little actual evidence to hang these claims on. And so people got disenchanted with this kind of theorizing and hand-waving. Up until the last couple of decades, finally, people have started doing real experiments, and there's now new data. And I hope to tell you about some of my favorite results today. Okay. Now, I want to tell you about four kind of classes of results that I think are important for different reasons. The first one will be big differences, where different speakers of different languages really think about the world in ways that seem qualitatively different or opposite to one another, something that really shows a big effect. The second one will be broad differences, differences that individually might not be very big. Each individual difference might be small, but they apply to a really broad range of things. You'll see what I mean later. A third one will be early influences, influences that happen very early in the cognitive processing stream. So as information is coming in, very early on, it's already affected by language. And the reason those are important is that you know, if you lose information early on, you can't get it back later. It affects everything that happens downstream. So I'll give you an example like that. And a final example I'll give you will be about linguistic differences that have, I think, important real-world consequences. So those are the four: big differences, broad, early influences, and real-world consequences. Okay. Now, to get started with the big differences, let's try an experiment right now. Why don't you guys all close your eyes and point southeast? Okay, don't cheat. You can open your eyes. You can see where everyone is pointing. I don't actually know which way it is myself. But as a psychologist, let me make a couple of observations about what you guys just did. First of all, there was a really long reaction time. It took you guys a long time to point. There was a pretty bad compliance rate. A lot of you didn't point at all. And I also assume the accuracy wasn't very high because you pointed in every possible direction. I don't actually know which direction it is, but I assume not all of them are correct. Now, don't feel bad. This happens every time I ask this question in an audience like this, or a group of professors at Stanford or Harvard act exactly the same way. But there are people in the world where you can ask a five-year-old that question, and they will point immediately. They won't think it's a ridiculous question. And they'll be correct. Now, that's a big difference in ability, right? A five-year-old in one culture can do something easily that very distinguished people in another culture, very learned people in another culture can't do. What explains it? Well, it turns out there are some places. I'm going to tell you about a particular place. This is a town of Pomporau. It's an Aboriginal community in Australia. And among the languages spoken there is a language, Kuuk-Thaayorre. Now, this language has a cool property. In this language, there are no words like left and right. And instead, all spatial directions are expressed in terms of north, south, east, and west. So you say things like, there's an ant on your southwest leg, or move the cup to the north-northeast a little bit. Now, to speak a language like this, you have to be oriented all the time. You don't have any option. Even to say hello in Kuuk-Thaayorre, so the way we say hello in English, you say, how are you? Fine. In Kuuk-Thaayorre, you say, which way are you going? And the answer should be something like, north-northwest in the far distance. How about you? So imagine as you're walking around your daily life, every person who you say hi to, you have to report your heading direction. You would have to stay oriented, right? You would, otherwise, you literally couldn't get past hello if you didn't know which way was which. So people who speak languages like this, and linguistic anthropologists like Steve Levinson and John Hovland describe lots of languages like this around the world, and they also documented that speakers of languages like this are incredibly good at staying oriented. They're very precise in their spatial gestures, so if you ask them to point southeast, they'll point southeast. If you ask them to point to their grandmother's house, they'll point to their grandmother's house. They seem to have spatial abilities that, in fact, we used to think humans didn't have. We used to always study Americans or other Europeans, and we'd say, well, humans are smart in lots of ways, but there are some ways in which birds are better than us because they can orient and they have magnets in their beaks. That was our excuse, right? Or, ants are really good at dead reckoning and orienting in this way, but it's because they're counting steps or they're using some other trick that we don't use. But now all of a sudden, here are people. They don't have magnets in their noses. They don't have any kind of hardware that we don't have. They're just paying attention to which way they're facing all the time. Because they have to speak their language. And by virtue of that, they stay oriented really, really well. Now, what's cool about people who think about space so differently is that that transfers to how they think about other things. Because the way we think about space is the basis for lots of other cognitive domains. So, for example, the way we think about time is often based on how we think about space. So this is an experiment that we wanted to do in Australia. Imagine this setup. I give you a set of pictures. Let's say they're pictures of Bill Cosby at different ages. I shuffle them up, I hand them to you, and I say, lay these out so that they're in the correct order. Well, the normal answer for an American English speaker would be to lay them out from left to right. That would be the correct order. So from the earliest, the youngest picture to the latest. And this left to right order has to do with writing direction. So if you ask Hebrew speakers or Arabic speakers to do this, they'd be much more likely to do it from right to left. But what will happen if you ask people who don't use words like left and right and don't think in terms of left and right to do this task? What will they do? So we went down there and we gave people sets of pictures like this, and we would test them facing in different directions. So one day you might be facing sitting south, another day you might be facing north. What happened? What we saw was something we'd never seen an American or any other person do before. When people were facing south, they would arrange the cards from left to right. When they were facing north, they would arrange them from right to left. When they were facing east, they would arrange them coming towards them. What's the pattern? From east to west. For them, time didn't go relative to the body. It didn't go relative to this relative direction of left, right, where's my left side, my right side. For them, it went with respect to the landscape, the motion of the sun in this case, most likely, right, from east to west. Now, that's a really big difference. That's thinking in an entirely different coordinate frame from English speakers. We've never seen an English speaker do that. Right? So that's a completely independent way of thinking about time. Now, here's another big difference. In English, we talk about time as it extends ahead of us and behind us, and the future is ahead and the past is behind. Right? So we say the best is ahead of us, we're looking forward to the next day, and so on. Or we can look back on times past. Now, there's some languages that reverse this completely. So Aymara is a language where the past is in front and the future is behind. And a couple of researchers, Rafael Nunez and Eve Sweetster, went down there and looked at how the Aymara gesture as they talk about time. And what they found is the Aymara actually point in front of them when they're talking about the past, and they point behind them when they're talking about the future. So the axis of time is completely flipped. And again, this goes against our kind of this visceral intuition that we have as English speakers that of course, the future is in front and the past is behind. How could the past be in front and the future behind us? That just seems wrong. And yet, there are folks in the world who talk that way, and they also gesture that way. Well, here's another difference. Time can be horizontal, like in English, we've already said. It can be ahead or behind us, or it can be vertical. So in Mandarin, in addition to horizontal terms, there are also really frequent vertical terms, up, down. So you say, the up month is the last month, the down month is the next month. And as a result, if you ask English speakers and Mandarin speakers to lay out time, Mandarin speakers are much more likely to put time on the vertical axis than our English speakers. And the two things that predict, so if you take bilinguals who speak English and Mandarin, the two things that predict whether or not someone is going to arrange time vertically or horizontally are how fluent someone is in Mandarin and whether they're being tested in Mandarin or not. So when they're thinking, when the bilinguals are thinking in Mandarin, they're more likely to arrange time vertically. When they're thinking in English, they're more likely to arrange time horizontally. Okay, so I've put these in the category, these examples from space and time in the category of big differences, because I think they show some really striking reversals. You know, the future can be ahead of you or can be behind you. It can be arranged from left to right or right to left. It can time can be in a completely different coordinate frame, independent of your orientation in space and entirely with respect to the landscape. Arranging time from east to west is something that most English speakers couldn't do because they don't know which way east and west are, right? And even those, you know, some people are pretty well oriented, so some people could in principle do it, but it would never occur to them to do it that way. Now, importantly, we can show in the lab that language, the patterns in language, have causal power, that they help create these patterns in thought. And the way we can do that is by manipulating language directly. So we can bring people into the lab, teach them a new way of talking. So bring English speakers into the lab, teach them to talk about time vertically, and see what difference that makes for how they think about time. And studies like that show that language actually has this kind of causal power. If you teach people to talk a different way, that teaches them to think differently too. It gives them new ideas, new ways of thinking about the world. Let me give you another example that I think is a really big, illustrates a really big cross-linguistic difference in thought. Now, in English, we take numbers for granted, right? So all of us here can count. We all know number words like 13 and 37, and these seem just like normal parts of any adult cognition. Now, there are some languages that don't have exact number words. Some languages have some number words, like they might have words like 1, 2, and 3, and after that it's few and many. And some languages don't have anything that could count as an exact number word. And there's a really striking difference in numerical knowledge that you can see. There are places where people don't count, where people don't have number words. People are also extremely unlikely to count, to be able to keep track of exact quantities. And places where people have number words, they're extremely likely to count and keep track of exact quantities. Now, counting, of course, is only one small thing. It's one small step. But it opens up the door to doing algebra, solving differential equations, being able to compute the trajectory to land a rocket on a comet 14 years from launch, being able to make a programmable coffee maker, all kinds of things that, you know, we enjoy. If you don't have number words, your chances of being able to enjoy any of those things are extremely low. Right? That's a really big transformative change. Number words are, of course, only one part of a whole cultural system. You need to have lots of other things in the culture to make that transformative change happen. But they're a really good predictor of whether or not that change is going to happen. Okay. So one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this set of differences is I think they highlight that some differences in cross-linguistic thinking are not just a matter of degree. There can be really transformative differences in cognition that come about through the gateway of language. Okay, so that's the big category. What about the broad category? Now, broad differences in cognition often are tied to grammatical features. So let's take a silly grammatical feature like grammatical gender. So lots of languages like Spanish or German divide all nouns into grammatical categories. So in Spanish, for example, all nouns are either masculine or feminine. And languages differ from one another in what gender they assign to different nouns. So for example, in German, the sun is feminine, but in Spanish, it's masculine. Or in German, the moon is masculine, but in Spanish, it's feminine. What is it? Does that actually have consequence for how people think? Do German speakers actually think of the sun as being somehow more female-like, more feminine than Spanish speakers do? Now, differences like grammatical gender, the reason I put them in the broad or pervasive category is, first of all, it's something that applies to all nouns, right? So that's already a whole lot of stuff. But it's worse than that, because not only is it something that applies to all nouns, it also draws in agreement from lots of other elements in a sentence. So take a language like Russian. In Russian, you have to change adjectives and number words and verbs and all kinds of other things to agree with the gender of the noun. So if you want to say something trivial like, my chair was white, in Russian, the word for chair would be grammatically masculine, so you would say, мой стул был белый. So you use the masculine form of my, then you say the word for chair, which is masculine. Then you use the masculine form of was, and then you use the masculine form of white. Mm. You've just marked the masculinity of a chair four times in four words. Right? you really don't have a lot of opportunity to forget the grammatical gender of a noun in a language. And this is, if you've ever tried to learn a language with grammatical gender, you know this can be extremely frustrating. Because it's, as a second language speaker, it's very, very hard to learn. Lots of people have commented on how frustrating it is. Mark Twain has a wonderful essay from the awful, he titled it The Awful German Language. It's about his experiences learning German, where he says, German doesn't make any sense. You know, a young woman has no sex, but a turnip has. Why? Why do Germans do this crazy thing? David Sedaris has a wonderful passage in Me Talk Pretty one day where he talks about his frustration trying to learn grammatical gender in French. And at some point, he simply gives up and decides to refer to everything in the plural. Because in the plural, you don't have to mark gender. And so he says, you know, why do we have 4 pounds of tomatoes? Where are we going to put them? Will it be between the two radios? Or should we just blend them in the two blenders? Let's see. So do people actually, I mean, given how silly these grammatical genders seem, do people actually take them as meaningful? Do Spanish, German, Russian speakers actually think of the moon, the sun, blenders, toasters, and tomatoes as being more masculine or more feminine, depending on the gender? Well, here are a couple of findings that suggest that people actually take them seriously. The first one is a really old study. In 1915, the Russian linguist Roman Jakobson did the following experiment with his classmates at Moscow University. He asked them to personify days of the week. This is something that Russians like to do for some reason anyway. So, you know, act like Monday or act like Wednesday. Well, different days of the week in Russian have different grammatical genders. And what he noticed was when people were acting like Monday, they would act like a man. But when they were acting like Wednesday, they would act like a woman, according to grammatical gender. In another set of studies, these studies are done with young kids. The advantage of doing studies with young kids is that they're less likely to figure out what the experimenter wants. So say, oh, you know, figure out what the control condition might be, and so on. So these kids are told, we're making an animated film. And here are a bunch of characters. And the characters might be animals or inanimate objects like a clock or an arrow. And the kids are told, we need your help picking the voices for these characters. Can you tell us what kind of voice each of these characters should have? And what the researchers find is that even very young kids, Spanish-speaking kids, already start assigning voices in agreement with grammatical gender. So if an object is masculine in grammatical gender, they'll want it to have a boy voice, and if it's feminine, they'll want it to have a girl voice. Another way to look at this is to look at art and personification in art. So we see personifications of abstract entities all the time. So think of the Statue of Liberty, right? So here's Liberty personified into a body, a female body. Well, why is Liberty female? Well, she's French. And in French, Liberty is grammatically feminine. And in fact, in a study we did, we looked at all the artworks, all the personifications and allegories that exist in ArtStore. This is an art database with millions of images in them. And to our surprise, we found that 78% of the time, we could predict the gender of a personification from the grammatical gender of the noun in the artist's native language. And that was a really high rate of predictability because, you know, these artists are painting things like love or death, things that you might have really personal relationships with and lots of idiosyncratic ideas about. And yet, despite all the personal relationships and idiosyncratic ideas, the fact that the simple quirk of grammar, whether something is masculine or feminine in your language, could predict what kind of personification it would be, 78% of the time was really striking. And again, in this range of studies, we can show that language actually has causal power, because you can bring people into the lab, teach them a new way of talking, so teach them either a new language or a language like Spanish or German, and see that learning to speak a particular way, learning a new grammatical category, actually makes a difference for how people think about inanimate objects. Okay. Now, why is this important? Grammatical gender seems like such a silly thing. What does it matter if you think of a chair as masculine or feminine? Well, the reason I put this in the important category is that grammatical gender applies to all nouns, right? This is a feature that is incredibly broad and pervasive in language. So if we can show that it matters for how you think about something, it means that language is subtly shaping how people think about anything that can be named by a noun. So you look around, think about how many things can be named by a noun. It's a lot of stuff, right? So that would be a very, very broad effect. Okay, let's talk about another example, early effects. And in this case, I want to turn to how languages talk about color. So languages divide up the world of color very, very differently. Some languages have lots and lots of words for color. Some languages have only a couple of words. So usually it's light and dark or cool and warm. And where languages put boundaries between colors really differs from language to language. So to give you an example, in Russian, there isn't a single word that covers the entire category that English calls blue. Instead, in Russian, there are two different words, one for light blue and one for dark blue. So Russians have to, in order to speak Russian, have to distinguish between light blues and dark blues. So light blues would be golubой, dark blues would be sini. And what we find in studies is the Russian speakers are actually better at discriminating light blues from dark blues. They're faster to make a discrimination between two shades of blue that span the Russian boundary. Whereas for English speakers, there's no difference whether the colors span the boundary or are in one of the Russian categories. And the reason we know that language is important in making this difference, I mean, anything could have made that difference. Maybe Russians see different color skies, or they have, you know, see lots of blue eyes, or you could always make lots and lots of hypotheses about what could have created such a difference. But the reason we know that language is important is that we stop people from being able to use language as they're making color judgments. The differences go away. So if you get people to repeat a bunch of syllables as they're making color judgments, all of a sudden the Russian speakers and the English speakers look the same. So there's nothing fundamentally different about how their eyes work. What's different is that Russian speakers have learned a linguistic system that's meddling in even these very basic color judgments. And it's not something specific to Russians. English speakers show the same effects across the blue-green boundary, which exists in English but doesn't exist in other languages, and so on. So for all of us, where we have a linguistic boundary, language is meddling in those decisions. And the reason I put this in the important category is, first of all, we never would have expected that language would matter even in such low-level tasks as just being able to distinguish two shades of a color. People always thought, well, those are really simple tasks. You know, you don't have to be very smart to be able to distinguish two shades of a color. You certainly don't need language to be able to do it. If you were a pigeon, you could do it. Right? Like you don't need a lot of sophisticated knowledge. And yet, once you've learned a language that makes a distinction, that that changes how you see the colors. Okay, one final category, and this is some differences that I think have important real-world consequences. Now, events in the world are complicated. Even a momentary event needs to be understood and construed in some way. So take the example, a few years ago, Vice President Dick Cheney at the time went out hunting with his friend Harry Whittington. And he had an accident. He accidentally shot Harry Whittington in the face. Now, there are lots of ways that we could describe and construe that event. It's a momentary event. It took a split second, right? It's a relatively simple physical event. But we have lots of options in language how to talk about it. So the European Herald had a headline, Cheney bags lawyer. Whittington was a lawyer. He went out hunting for lawyers, and he got one. That's the implication. You could say Cheney shot Whittington. Straightforward. You could say Whittington got shot by Cheney, putting Cheney a little bit to the side there. You could just say Whittington got shot. You could say what some newspapers in Texas said, Whittington got peppered pretty good. You could say what Cheney said. So Cheney, when he was taking full responsibility for this event, he said, well, ultimately, I'm the guy who pulled the trigger that fired the round that hit Harry. So split-second event, but now there are actually four different events, and he happens to be just one end of that chain of events. Bush actually did one better. Bush said something like, let's see. He said, he heard a bird flush, and he turned and pulled the trigger and saw his friend get wounded. That is a masterful exculpation. Cheney transforms from agent to mere witness in the course of a sentence. Now, the reason I give you these examples is they showcase how many different options we have for construing even a split-second event. And any event that we witness, we have to construe. Even if we don't realize we're doing it, we're thinking about it in some way, we're making sense of it in some way. We're thinking about who's an agent, who's responsible, is there an agent, what really caused this. And languages differ from one another in what kinds of ways are most likely to construe an event. So in English, for example, we really like agentive language. We like to say things like, he broke the vase. In other languages, like in Spanish, you'd be much more likely to say something like, the vase broke, or the vase broke itself. And in studies that have looked at potential differences between these groups, have found that English speakers actually pay a lot more attention to agents, even in accidental events, even in cases where the person didn't mean to do it. English speakers pay attention to agents. They remember who did it. Whereas Spanish speakers, when it's an intentional event, they pay attention and they remember who did it. But when it's an accident, they pay attention to other things more and less attention to the agent. It's not the agent that they would talk about when describing the event, and it's not what they remember about the event. So the focus is shifted. Okay. And I think these kinds of differences are important because they have consequences, of course, for things like eyewitness memory about events, what kinds of things do people remember about an event that they witness, and they also have consequences for blame and punishment, for how we think about who's responsible for what. Whether we do we blame people too much just because our language forces an agentive perspective? Do other people blame people too little? These are all interesting questions that we could start asking. Okay. Now, I've given you a lot of examples of how the languages we speak shape the way we think, the way we see the world, and perhaps help make us as smart and sophisticated as we are. I want to end with a quote from Noam Chomsky that, even though he has a very different perspective on language, this quote really resonates with me a lot. He says, when we study human language, we are approaching what some might call the human essence, the distinctive qualities of mind that are, so far as we know, unique to man. This quote really resonates with me because there really is something special about language. It really is about the human essence. But another thing that's undeniable about language is an incredible diversity of human languages. And that diversity is a testament to the incredible flexibility of human minds. Right? Human minds didn't create just one approach to the world, just one perspective on the world. We created 7,000 of them. Right? And all of these languages are like little parallel universes. Some of them might be quite similar to one another, but some are quite different. And each of them offers a different perspective, a different take, a different encapsulation of the world. And each one encapsulates thousands of years of cultural knowledge that people have developed in previous generations in that culture. And each of them invites a different way of seeing the world. I think it's a marvelous thing to study that diversity, both in language and in cognition, as a way of understanding the flexibility and the sophistication of human minds. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Professor Lyra Boroditsky for her fascinating... it's like an experience for me. I just find this incredible. I'm Karen Kiefer, a member of the International Relations Forum and your chair for this evening. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to How the Languages We Speak Shape the Way We Think with Professor Lyra Boroditsky. Those with questions, if you could raise your hand, the volunteer from the back of the room will take it to you.
Oh, good. Lots of questions.
While you're doing that, though, I'd like to ask the first question, which is, I'm very interested in the gender that you've been talking about. I always have a problem I've studied six languages, and a number of them have genders, and I get them mixed up all the time. I'm wondering what would happen if I said, like, El Luna and La Sol or whatever in Spanish. Or can you explain Esperanto, which takes away all that and makes it so easy Is it because we embrace our language so much that we don't want to learn a one that the world can easily speak?
Thank you for that question. So grammatical gender, as I mentioned, is really hard to learn. One thing that's, as a second language, one thing that's remarkable, though, is that when kids are learning a language with grammatical gender as their first language, they don't find it terribly hard. They seem to learn the gender as essentially being part of the word. It's not a separate thing that they learn. So their approach to learning it is very different. And as a result, kids speaking a language, even though they may make lots of errors, they rarely make grammatical gender errors. That's not the most common kind of error that they make, whereas foreigners make lots of grammatical gender errors. And I think part of it is that we think of the gender as something superfluous to the word, that it's something extra that you have to learn, whereas native speakers of a language with grammatical gender really think it's part and parcel of the word. It's part of the essence of the word. So I think that makes a big difference. And with languages like Esperanto, there have, as far as I know, there's never been an artificially created language that has really succeeded. Certainly people have invented languages when they wanted to talk to one another. So there are lots of sign languages where communities of signers have invented the language and it's really taken off. But there has, you know, in addition to Esperanto, there have been lots of other languages that have been proposed as kind of better universal languages, and they've never taken off. I think partially it's that so much of our identity is tied up with the language that we speak. And maybe travelers have had this experience. When you go to another country, you're speaking the other language. If it's rare to come across another American, you come across an American or anyone who speaks English, all of a sudden you feel this incredible commonality and relief, even though you may never have thought that person very similar to you if you encountered them in San Francisco. But the fact that they speak your language now in this new environment is somehow really, really comforting. There's lots of good evidence showing that the identity function of language is very powerful.
Yes, if you've done MRI studies, what do they tell you about how people are really built?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, all behavior emerges from the brain, right? So if you find differences in behavior, we know that that has to be implemented in the brain somehow. So at least as far as we know, that's where differences in cognition come from, is from the brain. The cross-cultural study of cognition in neuroscience is just beginning, but there are already some really cool findings. Especially in cultural neuroscience, people look, for example, at ideas of self and how they're instantiated in the brain. Do you think of yourself as being more separate from other people or more related to other people? So you can ask, for example, does the representation of yourself occupy the same neural real estate as your representation of other people? And that will vary across cultures. Individualistic cultures like American culture, your representation of the self tends to be quite separate from your representation of other people, whereas in more collectivist cultures, they seem to be more overlapping. And that's a difference you can see even in neural real estate, which I think is pretty cool. But I think a lot of findings from neuroscience are still to come.
Thank you for a very stimulating lecture. I have a couple of questions. Mm-hmm. In your research, were you able to exclude other factors that account for those differences other than language? I can think of some environmental issues, for example, that would account for one of the examples that you gave.
That's an excellent question, and that's something you always have to worry about when you're doing cross-cultural or cross-linguistic work. Because cross-cultural studies violate the basic structure of what an experiment should be. So the way an experiment should work is you bring your participants in, and it doesn't actually matter if your participants are people or pea plants, whatever it is that you're going to experiment on. And then you randomly assign them to two different treatment conditions, and you apply the treatment, and then you see if there's a different outcome, and that allows you to infer that whatever treatment you applied has causal power for the outcome. Now, let's apply that to a cross-linguistic study. You bring people into the lab, you randomly assign them to be English or Mandarin speakers, and then you see if that random assignment makes a difference, right? Well, of course, that's not how the study works. You bring people in, they're already English or Mandarin speakers, and with that, they bring all of the other cultural experiences that they've had. So how do we know that it's really some linguistic feature that I'm interested in as opposed to everything else? That this is a fundamental question for this field. The way people have answered that question, including our lab, is to experimentally manipulate language. And you can do that in a variety of ways. So one way is to teach people new ways of talking. So you bring English speakers into the lab, you randomly assign them to one language learning condition or another, and you see if learning one way of talking or another makes a difference. Another way of doing it is to try to experiment to block people from using language. So you bring people into the lab and you have them do the task either naturally, the way they want to do it, or you prevent them from using language during the task. And you see if that makes a difference. And that's another experimental manipulation you can apply. Another way you can do it is to take bilinguals, bring them into the lab and test them in one language or another. And so randomly assign them to be tested in one language or another. And again, see if that manipulation makes a difference. And all of those things produce effects. And so in each of the cases that I've told you about, that's the kind of manipulation that people would try to really nail down the causal power of language, specifically manipulate something about language in the lab and see if that manipulation makes a difference. And what that tells us is also the set of mechanisms that are involved.
There's a relatively new science called behavioral economics, mm-hmm. and it identifies biases where we tend to deviate from logic and make decisions based on instincts like herd instinct and all. And you need to override those when you're dealing with, like, investment. Has someone made a list if for English or maybe other languages of the biases generated by the weaknesses of the language? And also it sounds like there's a lack of precision frequently in language differences. Has someone made a list of that so we who speak American English can check the list and then be conscious that we need to override that when we're thinking about those particular things?
That would be awfully useful. I think that's still in the future. Certainly, all natural languages have a lot of ambiguity built into them. They don't have a logical structure the way say computer programming languages do, or the way mathematics does. And so, all languages will conflate some things and differentiate other things. All languages will introduce ambiguities. And you know, one way to think about it is that's a real problem. Natural languages aren't good to reason logically with, and I think philosophers have found that to be true over the years. But another way to think about it is, you know, that's the beauty of natural languages, is that they allow us perspectives. They allow us different ways of framing, different ways of taking a position on exactly the same physical reality. And in doing that, they allow us to go beyond what is in the physical world and to build more and more complex structures so that we can have things like investment. That's the result, you know, the fact that we can do things like make investments is a result of many, many generations of cultural building where people thought beyond the physical reality and the logical reality of what is in the here and now and just built these amazing sophisticated structures. So I don't think we necessarily want to override all of the biases that come from language. I think we could equally well celebrate them. But it would be really useful to have that kind of table. It would be a very long table. We haven't found any people in the world yet who are rational, so.
I'm wondering if there's been some work done with the evolution of language due to media and, you know, globalization of language through the use of media and computers, and how a lot of vocabulary is becoming universal throughout the world.
It's an excellent question. You know, languages are always changing and they're always borrowing things from one another. And that is that's a process that's been going on as long as as long as people have been communicating with one another, and it continues today. It's hard to know if the rate is really different now than it was before. People certainly love sharing words. for new things that they didn't talk about before. And words come in and out of new technologies. So there are examples where texting speak becomes part of speaking speak, and then it can then influence more texting speak and so on. And that, to me, again, is a testament to just how marvelously flexible we are as humans, that we're constantly inventing and trying new things, and some things are very sticky, and they stick, and they, you know, kind of are happy to infect others and spread out through the culture, and other things just kind of fall away. But there are, you know, people are very interested in language change, and it's an ever-present thing. Often it's framed as a, oh, it's a terrible thing that's happening right now. Kids these days, they don't talk properly. That's always been the case. Kids have never talked properly. That's the and some linguists joke that, you know, we'll know that languages have stopped changing when we can understand teenagers. That has never been true. So.
Some children are raised in bilingual families. Can they really be equally strong in both languages, or usually one stronger than the other?
Some people are perfectly balanced bilinguals, and others have a bias preference. It really depends on the person. The way to become a really balanced bilingual is to use both languages in all the contexts that you can. So kind of use them in every possible context and at the same time and things like that. But it is possible for kids to become perfectly bilingual, yeah, and trilingual. So,
I'm curious if you could tell us how you experience the world differently when you're in English and in Russian.
It's hard to introspect. You know, my job really as a psychologist is to do experiments, and I'm almost by edict disallowed from introspecting. You know, psychologists suffered greatly about 200 years ago when if you try to understand how the mind works by introspection, often you come to a theory that the mind works, the way that your theory says it works. But someone in the next office might have a different theory, and when they introspect, they come with come to a very different conclusion. So it's a little bit dangerous. For me, maybe relating to the last question, I'm not a balanced bilingual. I speak Russian in certain contexts, and I speak English in other contexts. And so it's very, you know, I think thinking about family or childhood, then I think in Russian. The kinds of differences that people have, other kinds of bilinguals have reported that I've heard a lot, for example, Spanish speakers will say, English has this very concise style where the purpose of communicating is to get to the point, and you're trying to get to the point as quickly as possible. Whereas in Spanish, it's a more discursive style, a more narrative style. You're not supposed to get to the point as quickly as possible. You're supposed to create an atmosphere, and that's a very different goal of communication. That I think creates a very different thing that people do in speaking languages, but also is a much harder thing to measure than the kinds of things that I told you about. Narrative style is something that's harder to get one's quantitative hands on.
Why is it that when all the other major European languages, at least that I know of, have gender, why does English not? It's basically based on a Germanic language, is it not?
The usual story about how English, English, of course, derives from German, and if you look at the other Germanic languages, so Dutch would be an intermediate case, and then English, they have started losing their gender. So Dutch used to have three genders, like German, feminine, masculine, and neuter. And at some point, the masculine and feminine got collapsed. So there's now just common and neuter. Those are the two genders in Dutch. And in English, there's now only biological gender. So we still, in pronouns, distinguish between biological males and females, he and she, but we don't do that for inanimate objects. And one common story about why that was is any language that has a lot of second language speakers tends to simplify morphology. So at some point, and it's actually the French that are blamed for this. So at some point, the Normans invading Britain, there are a lot of second language speakers of the language, and they couldn't get the genders right. And so they just fell away. That's, you know, it's something that happened over time. Very rarely does a change like that happen overnight. Once in a while, a change happens quickly, and people puzzle about how that happened. But it's something that, you know, just happened over time. But usually it's second language speakers, some kind of invasion of second language speakers that's blamed for it.
Speaking of genders, could you argue that Freud came out, Freud was the father of psychology and psychiatry and all that, that he couldn't have come out of Asia because in Chinese language, for example, you do have, you don't have genders, and you don't have to worry about what is masculine and feminine. I mean, is that possible?
And he could only have come out of Europe?
Clearly, we can only speculate about a question like that. There has recently been a study. So I should say that obviously, you know, there are languages that actually don't mark gender at all. So Finnish, for example, doesn't even distinguish between he and she. But obviously, there are other sources of information that people have outside of language, right? So it's not the case that Finnish speakers are only able to reproduce by virtually randomly bumping into each other. You know, once in a while, a happy accident occurs, right? Clearly, they've figured out biological gender, even though it doesn't, it's not marked in their language. So just because a language doesn't have something, I don't think we should assume that people don't have that idea. There are lots of other ways that you could get the idea. But there have recently been some studies showing that what if your language doesn't mark gender, biological gender, then that category actually becomes less salient. So one of my favorite studies actually is an old study by Alexander Giora, where he asked kids who are learning Finnish, kids who are learning English, and kids who are learning Hebrew as their first language. Simple question, are you a boy or a girl? So when do kids figure out if they're a boy or a girl? Hebrew marks gender like crazy. English is kind of in between, and Finnish doesn't mark gender. And what he found was the Hebrew-speaking kids figured it out earliest, and then the English-speaking kids, and then the Finnish-speaking kids. Eventually, they all figured it out, more or less, to the extent that it's possible. But then, you know, there was this developmental difference. And recently, there was another study comparing Mandarin-speaking and English-speaking adults. And they found some reaction time differences and processing differences, just showing that the category of gender is less salient for Mandarin speakers than it is for English speakers. Again, Mandarin speakers certainly know the difference between men and women. They're able to reproduce and all kinds of things, right? And so,
In the increased flexibility that you see with multilingual people, have there been any kind of experiments to show that there's increased flexibility in thought, for example, in, you know, flexibility in adjusting, flexibility in political thought, flexibility, tolerance, those kinds of things, that because now you're seeing things from multiple perspectives, or that now you have the nuance, that now you're more tolerant of, et cetera?
There is there's actually a lot of work on bilingualism. One prominent thinker in this field is Ellen Bialystok, and she finds specifically that kids who are growing up to be bilingual are better at tasks that require cognitive control, that require flexibility and ability to switch. And one reason she thinks that is you have to be able to realize what language different people speak, and you have to know that you can speak this language to that person, but not to that person. And you also realize that there are these different perspectives on the world, that two different languages can have totally different words for the same thing, and they can have different ways of approaching and framing the same situation. And so as a result, you do get these measurable differences in flexibility, even in kids.
I wonder if there's a historical as well as a linguistic dimension to to some of the variations you talk about. An example I have is from a recent class I took in Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale. And there are several passages in it where characters refer to the future as behind them, which is still quite puzzling to me.
That's really interesting. I'd love to see those. Certainly in modern... I'm easy to find. Certainly in modern English, the future is ahead, but as I mentioned, there are cultures around the world where the future goes behind. One question I have is whether having the future behind you and the past in front of you actually makes the past more present in some way, more visible. You take more advantage of the things that you've learned in the past. A question for future research.
Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question.
Back to gender and growing up with two languages. I grew up bilingual, two different languages. One is Indonesian, the other is Dutch. Mm-hmm. Okay, Indonesian has no gender, Dutch mm-hmm. has a gender. And I never thought about gender. It just doesn't sound right. Mm-hmm. You know, like with the house, head house, or the deur. Mm-hmm. So, and even when I don't think whether it's Dutch or Indonesian. I don't think any differently.
Some people report that. Some people who are very balanced bilinguals who grew up speaking both languages at the same time report that there isn't a switching difference for them. And other people who maybe speak the languages in different contexts report that there is a
switching. Except only sometimes with feelings. You know, if there are certain words in Indonesia can express in Dutch, I speak Dutch and then I insert an Indonesian word for it, or the other way around.
So, we did a bunch of experiments in Indonesia. I have a lab in Jakarta. I love Indonesia. One of the things we went there to test was this idea that an Indonesian student brought to me. I always ask people, what's the hardest thing to learn about English, or what mistakes do foreigners make when they try to learn your language? And she said something to me. She said, well, in Indonesian, we don't have tense marked on verbs, and so when you're speaking English, you're constantly having to keep track of these tenses. And at first, I didn't fully believe her that you could speak a language without including temporal information all the time. And so we made a bet. I bet her that she was wrong about her native language. I don't know why I would do that. So I sent her back to Indonesia and said, here, have people describe all these scenes. And, you know, she was right. At least half the time, Indonesians didn't put any kind of temporal marking into these scenarios. And so we ended up doing experiments there. But the first experience I had, when I went there to set up the lab, I hired a research assistant, and I was explaining to her the task. I said, well, we're going to show people these events. Here someone's about to kick the ball. Here someone's kicking the ball. Here someone has kicked the ball. And we want to know whether they remember which one it is. She looked at me, and she said, well, but why do you want to do this in Indonesia? People here don't care whether he's about to. Why don't you go somewhere where people care? And I said, maybe she's onto something. there are interesting differences that people have found in Indonesian, also with gender in Indonesian, where Indonesian, for example, marks age more than it marks gender in pronouns. And so Indonesians actually pay attention more to age. Some interesting differences.
Well, our thanks to Professor Lyra Boroditsky for her very informative and fascinating presentation this evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We also thank our audiences here as well as our radio audience. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you are always in the know, is adjourned.